WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. And it's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but
we have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into an abbreviated Monday Night Talk radio program. My name is Kevin Tachi, and we have a couple of great segments for you. Of course, don't forget, coming up at 7 o'clock, a political forum moderated by Christine James, featuring the candidates for Marshfield Board of Selectmen, Select Board. You make the call, but make sure you tune in at 7 o'clock for fantastic forum. What do we have on our plate this evening? Well, later on in the show, after a quick break, we'll have Casey Sherman, best-selling author, joining us to talk a little bit about a show that he's going to be doing at the Wilbur. This is all centered on his true crime podcast that does with the one and only Dave Wedge, where they've taken some of the podcast and turned them into a full-blown show. And if you haven't heard about this, well, you might want to tune into the segment and find out if there are any tickets left. But before that, we are going to be speaking with State Representative Allison Sullivan, who is actually here right now. Hello.
Hi.
Representative.
Hello, Kevin.
How goes the battle?
It goes it.
How's your Easter? You actually get a lot of news to talk about. You're like an auntie for like the 14th time.
It sometimes feels that way. It's the fourth baby my sister had. So she was born, Kaylee Jean was born last Sunday. So a week, you know, before Easter Sunday.
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful little girl. Tiny hands and tiny feet.
So what was your Easter? What was Easter like in the Sullivan household?
Easter was very quiet this year. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So usually Easter is somewhat quiet in our household. It's usually my mom side of the family where my aunt lives nearby with her kids and then her son, his wife, and their daughters. But unfortunately, this year it was just, not unfortunately, because it was very nice to have just the immediate family. I need to wish my little brother a happy birthday. It's his birthday today. So we celebrate his birthday.
Which brother?
My brother James, my baby brother.
Do we need to sing him happy birthday or something? I can have David Wolfson behind the glass.
I was going to say, I don't want to be the one singing, but maybe your voice would be a lot better.
No, it would scare listeners. We don't want people turning the dial. We have important stuff to talk about here.
Yes.
Coming up in a few minutes after traffic. So no big Easter dinner?
No, so with the baby being, you know, just a couple days old, we decided to have a very small Easter. So it was just the immediate family, which was nice.
I mean, I figured, like, Auntie be, like, putting candy and dollar bills and eggs. And
we usually do an egg hunt, and I usually do that. And Auntie's always the one who hides the Easter eggs. But because of my little cousins, they were actually away this Easter. So we're going to postpone the Easter egg hunt for when they're back.
Very interesting. Well, you and I have a discussion that we've been planning for some time now. A little bit more of an in-depth conversation in regards to the governor's dangerousness bill.
Yes.
And so this is an opportunity for us to kind of really vet this out, talk about the importance of it, where it stands, and for those who might be survivors out there, or maybe someone who might be living in a situation that is, you know, maybe they don't feel good, you know, maybe they can't get out of a particular relationship.
Right.
We'll talk about that, domestic violence.
Definitely,
and
yeah.
some of the things that are involved in this bill. So we'll do that in just a couple of moments.
Perfect.
Hey, it's Geoff. That's what my friends call me, Geoff. 6'1", 190. I grew up on the South Shore, and now I live on the South Coast. Trust me, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm just like you. I have two little girls that are the same as yours. My wife and I go to work while they go to school, just like you. We watch reality TV and participate in social media, just like you. Mal keeps the books while I move things, pick things up, and put things down. Our friends are just like us. We all just want to live, work, and play freely. Thank you to the brave men and women who gave their lives. Thank you to the brave men and women who are currently giving their lives. Thank you to the brave civil servants that are serving our country every day. Thank you to the truck drivers and all of the workers that keep this country going. You are my heroes. You are amazing. You keep doing what you're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing. As long as we can, forever and ever, until death do us part. Like you, we stand with Ukraine. Like you, we stand for freedom. Our hearts and our prayers go out to all the people around the Ukraine. Godspeed. This message was brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Thank you for keeping that radio dial set right there. And yes, indeed, we have Allison Sullivan. Now, normally, traditionally, it's the State House Report, but this is a little bit more of an opportunity to talk about a piece of legislation that is in the works. And we've touched upon it a few times when Allison has been here. But the idea is to have it a little bit more of an in-depth conversation, drill down in regards to this dangerousness bill. I will tell you, and I told you this off air, and I'll tell you this in person, and I know that the newsroom had covered an event that had taken place at the Whitman Hanson Regional High School. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Governor was there. You were there. There were all other individuals were there. But the portion that they captured of you kind of talking about what it's like to be living in a situation that, you know, you don't feel safe.
Right.
And depicting that, I thought it was powerful. It was a powerful sound clip, and it was compelling.
Thank you.
But the hope here is that we want this to be more than compelling. We want this to be something that is on the books.
Yes.
And that folks who are survivors, folks who are victims, have something to lean on if they need to be out of a situation like that. And that the state, the law enforcement, will have something, they'll have teeth when it comes to an individual who will not let go of a relationship.
It's not even just our police officers and law enforcement, it's our criminal justice system as a whole, you know, and I think you've said it, where survivors and victims who are currently living in a situation similar to what I lived through, knowing that they have the resources that are available and the safety nets, right? The safety tools that will protect them, not just in that day and in that moment, but going forward. Because right now, yes, do we have the dangerous hearing available? We do. But there's very much limitations both to when you can ask for that hearing and who qualifies to have that hearing. What crimes qualify to have a dangerous hearing? I mean, I don't know about you, but a child molester and someone who is found guilty of having a number of child pornography in their possession should be someone who qualifies to have a dangerous hearing. I would say that person should be able to qualify to have a dangerous hearing. And that's one of the many other crimes that we're looking to expand to allow for a dangerous hearing.
Have you had a chance to have a conversation with Governor Baker and his team about why he decided to file this bill? Was there more than one legislator who went to him and said, this needs your muscle to be able to have this, for it to be taken, I don't want to say taken seriously, but for it to be something that's seen as though it's a need, it's something that there's an immediacy to having it looked at, go into committee, discussed, and then ultimately be voted on and signed?
So I have not had any type of particular conversation regarding that exact question that you're asking. However, I know our Lieutenant Governor, Karen Polito, has been a strong advocate and allies for survivors of domestic violence. Her team up at the state level has done critical and very important work when it comes to fixing some of these loopholes that we have. And it's not by, I think, any great intention, right? But that there are always going to be potential loopholes when filing legislation and passing legislation, those unintended consequences, right? So her team up at the State House has done their due diligence on looking at already established law and where the shortfalls are happening. So I don't know if it was necessarily a legislator that came to Governor Baker or if it was advocates that came to Lieutenant Governor. I don't know the particulars on that. He may have talked about it in the past that I'm not aware of. I just know that this time around, he's having these roundtable events throughout our Commonwealth with survivors and Lieutenant Governor and Secretary Reedy. And these are powerful conversations that are happening across the Commonwealth. It's just not being talked about by the governor. It is something that he is passionate about getting past this legislative session.
Is this something that this, according to an act to protect victims of crimes and the public, it says here in the press release that it was first filed in 2018?
Yes. Yes. This is his third go around on filing this legislation. Unfortunately, the last two legislative sessions, it hasn't been able to go through. I think slightly maybe because of the pandemic and you know, 2020. Unfortunately, a lot of things became placed on the back burner. Because of the pandemic, we had to pivot and really focus in on the necessary needs in that current moment. So a lot of key pieces of legislation didn't go through the House and the Senate at that time. But this has been something that he and his team, and including Lieutenant Governor, like you said, we did an event at Whitman Hanson. And thank you to the superintendent, Jeff Simonak, for allowing us to be there and have those. And Dr. Jones, Principal Dr. Jones, to have those conversations with the freshmen and the seniors. And I believe there might have been some sophomores and juniors in the class as well. But it was that in itself was powerful. I think that was the first time I actually cried telling my story, because it became more real in the sense that I'm talking to kids that were the same age I was when I first got involved with my abuser.
Reading the room, how did it feel that they soaked it in?
Oh, wow. They were, you could hear a pin drop. You know, they were attentive. They weren't fidgeting. They weren't looking at their phones. They weren't looking at their watches. They weren't wondering if it was done yet. A lot of them stayed, even lingered after the fact. They signed a banner. They took the pledges, both with the Respectfully campaign and also the White Ribbon Day pledge, which says that, you know, they're not going to stand by and sit silently by if they ever were to witness acts of violence against others. And then others even approached after the presentation and asked how they can get involved both with the Respectfully campaign and also the White Ribbon campaign.
So what this particular bill, if and when it passes, and the hope here is that...
Hope is... when.
Third time is the charm.
When, not if. Yes,
right, when,
exactly.
Not if. It passes... talk about protections that it's going to provide to the survivors and any loopholes that it may conceivably close.
You know, this bill is actually a very in-depth bill, and it goes from, you know, with the dangerous hearing all the way to a bracelet, a GPS bracelet, and everything in between. So I don't know if the whole bill in its entirety will be passed. There may be some conversations being had between the Senate President, the Speaker, and the Governor regarding what is the most important pieces of this legislation, what would they want, what would they be okay with having passed. And I think personally for me, one of the key pieces of this legislation that I think needs to stay in there no matter what discussions we have is the expansion of a dangerous hearing. Because right now, a prosecutor's office can only ask for a dangerous hearing at the time of arraignment. And I don't know, Kevin, if you're familiar with our criminal justice system, but a lot of our ADAs are overworked, underpaid, and they don't always know the entire case in front of them at the time of arraignment. They don't always have the ability to get those resources they need to prove that this individual in front of them is a dangerous person. So sometimes they don't have those resources at that one particular hearing, arraignment, which usually happens, I believe, within 24 to 48 hours after a person's arrested, sometimes within the same day, depending on what time this person gets arrested. So when you look at a matter of minutes to hours to a couple of days on getting that evidence needed to prepare for a dangerous hearing, that's practically nearly impossible. So the expansion of allowing a dangerous hearing to happen at any point during trial is key in the protections of survivors of domestic violence. Another piece is expanding the duration when you can hold someone. Right now, it's, I believe, the maximum is 120 days, and I believe the minimum is 90 days. I don't know about you, Kevin, but I don't think anyone becomes less dangerous after 90 days of being in jail.
Right.
And from speaking from experience, I think they become more dangerous if they were to be released after 90 days to 120 days. Because in that time frame, they have all this time to calculate how and when they're going to harm their victim again, if they had that opportunity to do so.
Where is this bill currently in the legislative process?
So right now we had an expansion on the judiciary poll. We expanded the deadline to have it come out of committee. So I know there's conversations being had between some very important people up at the State House. And hopefully we're getting a bill worked out that it will be both effective in protecting victims of domestic violence.
Any concerns that if this goes to a conference committee, that some of
the necessary pieces
that will somehow be stripped away? As somebody who's a survivor of such a situation, mm-hmm. Are you not concerned about that?
I am. I am very much concerned on what this bill may look like if a lot of these key pieces are taken out. You know, I luckily the system worked for me, and I never have said that it hadn't. But I had a team of law enforcement, ADAs, and advocates that knew my abuser well and knew how dangerous that individual was. So they worked overtime in the sense of making sure that they had all the evidence they needed for the prosecutor's office to hold this individual. Sometimes that perpetrator isn't always known to law enforcement, isn't always known to the DA's office, manipulates the system so that they don't look like, you know, this monster that they really are, points the finger back at the victim, knows the key words. I mean, they're con artists and they're good at what they do. So I think if key pieces of this legislation are taken out, then it's not doing what its intent is supposed to be doing.
Some of the in one of the press releases kind of talks about some of the additional elements that are contained in this proposal. One of them is regards to fingerprints.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about the importance of making sure that that individuals are fingerprinted correctly, depending on what this if the situation is that they are taken into custody for.
Well, you always want to know who you're dealing with and if they have any outstanding warrants in other cities, towns, or even states. So the purpose of taking a fingerprint is to really identify who's in front of you. Like I said, they're really good con artists. You could say your name's Kevin, but it could be something else. And if we take those fingerprints and have that data and make sure that we're establishing record of who you are, then it protects the victims even further.
How about as far as when you're collecting data from a perpetrator, that there's a tracking system, and it's not just with one agency, a law enforcement group, but that it's somehow it's cross-pollinated amongst everybody.
What do you mean?
As far as making sure that the data is making it on all levels, whether
how
it's
important that is.
Yeah,
I mean it's really important, but sometimes it's not. We're all human, right? So sometimes it's not always done seamlessly. But it's very important because someone may, you know, my abuser, for instance, he might have an open warrant here in Massachusetts, but be living in a different state, gets arrested in another state, and it never pops up that he has a warrant, an active warrant here in Massachusetts for, you know, back when the things happened to me, back, you know, if he escaped or eluded law enforcement, to have that kind of background would be very important.
I find it interesting that another element that's part of this is a new felony that's created if an individual actually cuts off a court-ordered GPS. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is lacking right now as to something that's on the books? If an individual is, here we go, we're going to let you go home free, and you're going to stay within the parameters. Is this real that someone would be silly enough to cut it off?
Yes. So I had, I don't know if you listened to some of the testimony that happened down in Plymouth when we did a roundtable event with other survivors. I believe there was about 10 survivors there, including myself. And two of them actually spoke directly to, maybe even three spoke directly to this element in here. And their abuser actually, one alleged that the TSA agent cut off his GPS bracelet. Another one said that it just miraculously, I believe, fell off his ankle, which I don't see that happening.
Really? Just fell right off?
Yes, yes. And then, and outside of, and not just dealing with domestic violence abusers, but outside of just any criminal that's being released on a GPS monitor, they are now, it's almost like a catch and release system, right? And the courts aren't holding it in a serious way, in a serious manner, when someone cuts off a GPS bracelet, and it should be. We're using the GPS bracelet as an alternative to being incarcerated. So they should be treated as such when, you know, you have an ankle monitor on you, that you're following the rules and guidelines of that ankle monitor. And there has been crimes that have been committed throughout the Commonwealth where an individual cuts off his ankle monitor and goes and repeats another crime while being on a GPS monitor and still getting a slap on the wrist. And it's very heartbreaking to hear, and especially when maybe a life is lost from someone who's on an ankle monitor by someone who's supposed to be in the confines of their own home at a certain time, cuts off that bracelet, and then goes out and commits a crime and potentially takes the life of another. It is becoming more and more common because of the use of GPS systems. So we should have a place in here that makes it a felony when doing such. And that way there, it deters people from cutting off their ankle monitor in the first place.
Again, we're speaking with State Representative Allison Sullivan. She's here. We're talking about the dangerousness of bill that is actually in the process right now. Hopefully it's something that is signed before the end of the legislative session come December. Hopefully well before that.
Yes, I would love to see that.
Something I want to just kind of throw out there. Do you feel that there are more people, more individuals who are living in fear and in unsafe relationships because they fear for their own safety? And maybe if there is some legislation like this on the books, they would feel safer to depart from that relationship, knowing that they don't have to fear for their lives?
Yes. As simply as I can put it, yes. If you listen to testimony from victims and survivors across the Commonwealth, a lot of the common stories you will hear is the criminal justice failed them in some way, shape, or form. The police aren't doing enough, not because they can't, but because they're not allowed to by law. The judges aren't doing enough, simply because they can't, because of they're not allowed to by law. The DA's office isn't doing enough. Unfortunately, like I said, there's an unintended consequence in the current law. There's a loophole in the current law that more so protects perpetrators than it does victims. And I think if this bill was to pass, you'll find more victims coming forward because of the resources and the expansion and the time that it may take to find someone dangerous will be there.
Another interesting element that's added into this is that the requirement of probation departments, bail commissioners, and bail magistrates to notify authorities who can actually take action when a person is on pretrial release, commits a new offense anywhere in the Commonwealth or anywhere else. Is this something that's really needed? Do we not have something that says if someone's a repeat offender that, you know, if they're out on release that, you know, we need to have something that's in black and white that says that?
I mean, unfortunately, yes. You know, where it's not being practiced across the Commonwealth, where you think that if you are committed a crime and you're on bail, you're out on bail, that most of the times if you ever sit in a criminal justice, you know, hearing, you will hear the judge said, okay, you're being released on bail, and if you violate these orders, then you will be held up to such and such amount of time in jail because of the violation of your bail. Does it always happen? No. So I think having that safeguard in there where it's in black and white, where there's no interpretation to be had of whether or not you're required to or not, now I would say definitely you are required. Another safeguard, like I said.
As we have a few more minutes left here with you, anything that we haven't touched upon in regards to this, anything that maybe while we have the attention of our listeners here mm-hmm. on the South Shore that they can do in regards to their local state rep, state senator to somehow be a supporter of this, a vote on this when it does come out of committee or if it does come before them?
Yes, I mean, I think the more our state legislators, my colleagues, hear from their constituents regarding this piece of legislation in favor of, asking them to support this, asking them that when, like you said, when a vote does come before them, to support it, and to really advocate to both the judiciary, the joint judiciary, and the governor to get this bill passed. I think that doesn't do a disservice to it at all. It would actually help.
Any advice you'd want to share to someone who may be living in a situation like this that you could share with them as a survivor?
I think what you need to do is know your instincts, know when it's safe to reach out for help, find the resources around you. I know we have a great community resource here in the South Shore, and I can give you their number right now, and it's South Shore Resource Center and Advocacy Center, and it's 508-746-2664. They are great there. They will listen. They will help. And you are not alone. You will be believed. And if you ever need someone to reach out to, my office is always open. My phone is always on. Feel free to reach out to me as well.
Well, now, who has filled the big shoes that have been left by your departing Curtis?
I know. Curtis is great. Curtis will be missed very much. But yes. Catherine Mullen is a resident of East Bridgewater.
Nice.
She was an intern in my office in 2019, and she has started with the office. She's great. And she knows very much how important this is to me personally and professionally on this piece of legislation. So if you ever have any questions or concerns regarding this legislation, don't hesitate to reach out to my office as well.
Anything else that we want to touch upon in regards to this dangerousness bill that we've sat here and discussed?
I think people need to take a step back and realize victims will leave their situation multiple times, and it'll take multiple times before they can leave it permanently. And some people haven't had the opportunity to leave it permanently. Their life is taken by their abuser. So if you do know someone that is in a similar situation to stuff we've been talking about, be patient with them. Know that it's not them that you're really talking to. It's someone, a shell of who they really are. And give it time and just be there when you can.
She is State Representative Alice Sullivan. She is representing the folks in the 7th Plymouth District.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it.
You got it. We are going to step aside just for a moment. We're not going to go far. Coming up next, Casey Sherman. Don't go anywhere. You're tuned in to Monday Night Talk. Here at 95.9 WATD.
Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The pandemic is over and life is finally returning to normal. It's time to return to McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman. Come enjoy Shepherd's Pie, a pint of Guinness, and one of the best pizzas you'll ever have on the South Shore. Play single Wednesday nights at McGuigan's or listen to the live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night. For comfort food with an Irish pub atmosphere, go to McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out the patio at McGuigan's next door at 552 Washington Street.
Hi, my name is Alex Bazantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the executive board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbazantin.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Bazantin for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
Each year, about 1 out of 2 men and 1 out of 3 women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
Give me that thing, give me that, give me that, give me that, give me that thing. Tiny of Tiny Sun's Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield.
Ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing the gimme gimme that ding.
So gimme that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
Find Monday Night Talk on Facebook and share your opinions. Go to 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
We return for the abbreviated version of Monday Night Talk. As you know, coming up top of the hour, WATD Political Forum with candidates who are running for the Marshfield Board of Selectmen or Marshfield Select Board, of course, headed up by moderator Christine James. But we still have one small piece of business to do here. Joining me as he and his partner in crime sometimes do, we have Casey Sherman. And when I'm talking about partner in crime, I'm talking about the gentleman that he's written a few books with, Dave Wedge. But Casey is here to talk about an event coming up at the Wilbur this coming Wednesday night.
That's right.
Saints, sinners, and serial killers on stage.
It's an exciting, it's an exciting opportunity for us to present our stories and our books and our investigations to a live audience.
We should, though, start off by, you know, here today being Marathon Monday. I would be remiss if we didn't take a moment to remember individuals who were lost and injured during the Boston Marathon bombing. And let's not forget something that you and Dave documented well, not only in a book, but was also made into a movie. Give your thoughts as to what this, you know, this day will forever mean for all of us here at Boston.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you taking that opportunity, Kevin, because on this day 9 years ago, a city, a region, a country really changed forever. And Dave and I had the task of chronicling the stories of several survivors of the Boston Marathon, families who had lost their loved ones that day, first responders who went into the smoke and fire for one simple reason, to save human lives. And out of that epic tragedy, you know, we found love and we found resilience and we found strength. And, you know, every day is Marathon Monday for all of the survivors that, you know, escaped with their lives that day. But, you know, they escaped with parts of themselves gone forever. And we always need to remember that, not only, you know, a day like today, but every day I wake up thinking, how does Heather Abbott get up today? Heather Abbott was a young woman who lost her leg in the Boston Marathon bombings. And now she has taken it upon herself to start her own foundation that helps people like her with prosthetic limbs because they're very expensive. So you're talking about some amazing people that I've had the great fortune to know and write about.
Just interesting enough in that is that you have a fantastic event that's coming up, and I wish we had more time to touch upon it, but I wanted to make sure that we paid tribute and that we did mention it. And the hard work that went into telling those stories was also something that we shone a light on just for a moment before, you know, we kind of moved right into the business at hand. Sure. Something that is phenomenal, probably something that hasn't been seen, you know, something that was grown here locally with yourself and Dave being able to play out your books like Whitey Bulger, the Boston Strangler, just to name a few things. What has it been like getting ready for your big event this coming Wednesday at the Wilbur?
Yeah, it's been a kind of a natural progression from us writing the books to us starting our own true crime podcast. And then now we're going to be taking these stories directly to a live stage audience. And the interesting thing about this, Kevin, is that it's not just Dave and I on stage recounting our tales. We've collected an ensemble cast of some great local theater and film actors who are going to be playing, you know, Whitey Bulger for the first time on a Boston stage, the Boston Strangler for the first time on a Boston stage. And we're not glorifying these criminals. We're really deconstructing the mythology around those criminals. So we've got four acts that we're going to be presenting to the audience on Wednesday: the Boston Strangler, Whitey Bulger, a very controversial police stop in Franconia, New Hampshire, that I wrote about years ago. And the coda for our theatrical event is the Last Days of John Lennon, which was a book that we wrote with James Patterson last year. And we've got actors playing John and Yoko. We've got an actor playing Mark David Chapman. So, you know, the audience can almost see in real time how this collision course unfolded, you know, tragically for one of the greatest, if not the greatest, musician that ever lived.
What has it been like to get prepared in a quaint setting like the Wilbur? The Wilbur isn't like the TD Garden. It's kind of a cozy setup.
It's a beautiful, cozy setup, and it's very intimate, and that's the type of atmosphere we want. You know, we want the audience to just let these stories wash over them. And, you know, we've got in our Whitey Bulger act, when Whitey Bulger is arrested and captured by the FBI, we recreate that on stage for the audience. And it's Bulger in his own words. Now, Dave and I got access to letters that Whitey Bulger had written from prison describing how he was captured by the FBI. So our actor, Paul Kandarian, an incredible local actor, has got the big responsibility of playing Whitey and describing to the audience what it actually feels like as he's going down into the basement to be confronted by the FBI.
So how does this work? And I want to throw in a plug for Mike Joshua, your producer.
Absolutely,
Funhouse
yeah.
Media. Fantastic talent in his own right. How does this play out? What is your role and Dave's role? Are you kind of off stage, or are you narrators? What's your role in this whole thing?
We're almost like the you know, TV anchors. We're going to be on stage in the middle of the stage for 90 minutes, you know, providing the connective tissue through these stories. And as you know, Kevin, that, you know, Dave and I didn't just write these books. We lived them. For the Boston Strangler, my aunt was the final and youngest victim. So there is a lot of heart and soul in that particular story, much as there is in all of the stories that we tell. And we've just got, you know, the luxury of so many talented actors that are volunteering to, you know, put this stage show on, because it's the first of its kind anywhere in the country. We've got Ian Barrett, who's our director, incredible director, Chris Meyer, who produces all the Adam Sandler and Farrelly Brothers movies. He's our producer on the project. So we've got a lot of talent on one stage, and we can't wait to show it to the audience.
You look back way, way back when you were, you know, just starting out, whether it was someone who was a producer at CBS or, you know, cutting your teeth by, you know, writing for a local scribe. You look at where you are now. I mean, do you look back and go, wow, what a journey?
I look back at it, and it's, wow, what a journey, but it's not me beating my chest, Kevin. It's
no.
How many people did I get to meet? You know, the stories that I've had the opportunity to write. It's been a journey, and that's exactly the best way to describe it. There's no ending to it. You know, when The Finest Hours premiered at the Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood, I thought, well, that's the pinnacle of my career. But then I looked at, well, there are other mountains to climb and other stories that are worth telling. And, you know, we love to write, Dave and I, and it's what we do. And our passion is bringing stories to mass audiences. And we're very lucky that way.
Let's give folks now, are there any tickets left, or is this a sold out event?
A very fast selling theater performance. But like you said, Kevin, it's an intimate theater. So there's not a bad seat in the house.
Right.
People can go to thewilbur.com, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, and tickets are $30 a piece. So it's an easy night out for anybody that wants to take it on.
Now, I love looking back. I like talking about the present, but I also, when I have you on, I like to give folks a little bit of a peek of the future. And you got something on the horizon. You want to kind of tease that for the fine folks who are tuned in?
Sure, I appreciate it. I've got a book coming out July 12th called Helltown. It's the untold story of a serial murder case on Cape Cod, and it's the true story of a serial killer on the Cape back in 1969. It's a prelude to the Manson case, and it involves two major writers, Kurt Vonnegut and Norman Mailer, who become obsessed with this case. It's a very gruesome case, but the way, you know, my way into it is more of a literary nonfiction take on it. It just got, fortunately for me and my publisher, a starred review from Booklist, which is one of the major reviewers in, you know, literary publications. So I can't wait to share that story with everybody. And that was about 2 years in the making. And, you know, I can't wait to get on the road again, Kevin, and do these book signings and meet people and talk about the process of writing and investigations. I love doing that.
Would you advise anybody to, can they pre-order the your Helltown if possible? Is there a way?
Yeah, absolutely. Go right on to Amazon.com. You can pre-order Helltown. You'll be the first one to get it when it comes out, because Amazon always does deliver early, which is fantastic. And, you know, it's a tome. It's 400 and some odd pages, and it wraps up, you know, an incredible decade in American history, the 1960s. So in 1969, surrounding this murder case, you've got Chappaquiddick. You've got the moon landing. You've got the war in Vietnam. We're just coming out of the 1968 Democratic Convention. So I fold a lot of those themes into this story as well.
It's also worth noting, it's funny you mentioned about Amazon and kind of given the one I've received some heads up about early sales if I want to get it. Also, if somebody is an enthusiast when it comes to audiobooks, I believe that your audiobook is also available.
It will be. Narrating that audiobook for the first time, Kevin, which I've never done for any of my books. You know, the publishers always hire a Broadway actor or somebody like that. But they asked me to do it, and it's been a joy. It's a lot of work, a lot of hours in the recording studio, which I wasn't prepared for. But I can't wait for people to hear it.
Finally, before we go, again, a reminder that we're speaking with Casey Sherman, best-selling author, as we've chatted with him mainly about Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers coming to the stage, Wilbur, this coming Wednesday, April 20th. I do have to ask, will you have any books? If there's any fans in the audience that may want a book, is there any plans to have any at the theater, or not so much?
Not so much that night, Kevin, just because we're leaving it all on the stage that night. You know, we'll be available for book signings at future dates. But and this is really an opportunity for our cast. We really want to elevate our cast and give them their moment to shine along with us. So I can't wait for that.
Well, I say congratulations to you on, you know, the evolution of Casey Sherman from the journalist to, I mean, you do a little bit of everything, production company, and as you talk about spending hours in the studio, just, you know, crafting your audiobooks.
Sure.
To the stage show, which, you know, who knows? Maybe you'll be coming on soon to tell us that this is going to be going on tour around the country. That would be pretty cool.
And that's the goal. You know, we want to bring this to Broadway. We want to bring this to L.A., potentially London, with different stories. It doesn't have to be the four we're discussing that night. And, you know, going back in my history, I mean, I wanted to be a tap dancer when I grew up, Kevin. I wanted to be Gene Kelly or Fred Astaire. So, you know, the ability to get up and perform on stage is something I take very seriously and something I love a lot.
So if you are somebody who loves true crime, if you are a fan of Casey Sherman, Dave Wedge, this is a show that you do not want to miss. Anything you want to say as we wrap up this segment and say goodbye for the evening, my friend?
I will say that it's a night of true crime, and there are going to be a lot of terrifying moments, but there's a lot of humor sprinkled in that show as well, because there's so much absurd humor when it comes to these types of investigations. So I think people will laugh. People will be put on the edge of their seats and ultimately informed and entertained on a night that I doubt they've ever seen before.
Well, again, thank you for joining us and giving us, as always, a heads up as to some of the projects and things that you're working on. It's really appreciated.
Thank you, Kevin. Great show. Appreciate it.
Got it. All right. Well, that's all the program that we have, the Monday night program that we have coming up in just a few moments. Christine James, moderator, and the WATD news team, as they provide you the Marshfield Select Board candidates looking for your vote. Coming up in just a few moments. Till next week at 6:15 p.m., at least for the show program of this portion of this, have yourself a great night.